So I'm just so grateful to be here today, and I have a couple of things just to start off with. This is my 31st year as a clinician, and I am humbled by people in the field who I've known for many years who've stayed ethical for the ups and the downs and the this and the that. And I was here when we had indemnity insurance, and you could simply just decide what was clinically necessary based on acuity and get the treatment that they needed. And then I lived all the way through the roller coaster down of managed care. And I have to say, I may cry when I'm saying this, but my first ethical teacher was my dad, who is in St. Rafe's Hospital right now, not doing great, but he looks like he's gonna pull through from a broken hip. I've been there actually 2.5 weeks straight, sleeping in a chair. So I went home last night because I had to have a good night's sleep. But when I was young, hard to believe, I was very mouthy and very good at manipulating, and my dad didn't, he just didn't take any shit whatsoever, and not in a mean way, but he was raised before we had a social safety net, for those of you that don't know. So people in their late 80s were raised before there was a social safety net in the United States, before FDR and the New Deal. And contrary to popular belief, elderly people died alone on the street and in poor houses, etc. Like, it was a different United States. And my father, unfortunately, did okay till he was 14 years old, and then his father died of a heart attack. And he became from lower middle class, even though my grandfather was educated in Ireland, came over and then, you know, worked on the railway system, the subway system in New York City. But there were no pensions, there were nothing, and he had to go to work for the New York Public Library. And he had a network of kind, ethical people who helped him get a full scholarship to Princeton, Fordham, Wharton. My father actually graduated from Wharton, unlike other alleged alumni who did not graduate. And I looked it up. And he just didn't take any shit. He just didn't take any shit, not because he was a mean person, but, you know, Anatole France, who was the Nobel Prize-winning poet, who was part of the French Resistance in World War II, famously said, if 50 million people say a foolish thing, it's still a foolish thing. And that was written in French all over the metro during the French Resistance. So my dad taught me, and the Jesuits too. I went to Jesuit schools a lot of my life. They taught us logic. How many people had logic classes in school? And if you went to law school, you had to do that too. But to be logical, your a priori assumption, so the first thing you start with, has to be logical. Because if you start with a bad premise, then you could actually prove your premise, but it could all be, as we say in insight sometimes, poopoo caca. That's how we find it. When we try to confront teenagers and get them to tell the truth, we start using like humor on them, we roast them. So let's be very clear that you can be doing things that are legal in the field and be unethical according to your licensing or according to ethical principles. So I want to say that again. And I've seen this happen. Managed care. Do you know how managed care came to be? Because I was there when it happened. Uh-oh, we thought we had this. What do we do, dude? Do I minimize? What do I do? So in 1985, on a pork bill in the Senate and the Congress, so it was an appropriation bill for transportation and other funding.
Is that what you were?
Yeah, baby, thank you. Wait, is that going to keep going? Can we just see? Yay, it's going to keep going. Okay. And I have to say, indemnity insurance had a lot of abuses. I worked at a very famous hospital that will remain nameless, my second job in the field. I worked at the VA hospital for my first job in the field. At the time of, I was working at the VA hospital in West Haven. I had no idea what the heck I was doing. I was 22. When deinstitutionalization happened under Ronald Reagan, and we were going to release all the poor people that were trapped in mental hospitals, and we were going to pump money into the community, and we were going to have them be free and happy and great. And what would happen was we gave them $100 cash and a bus ticket to the largest central urban area. And some families took their loved ones home that could. And I was working at the VA hospital when this happened, so I'll tell you, overnight we were flooded with thousands of homeless mentally ill vets, most of whom had severe schizophrenia, and at that time we didn't have Clozaril, we didn't have some of the medicines now. It was a nightmare. It was overnight. I mean, there were some homeless already. Probably before 1985 and 84, there were probably a lot of people homeless by choice, meaning that, you know, social services would try to get them into programs and they'd say no thank you. And that is a problem with the chronically mentally ill. So policy can have a dramatic effect on people's lives. but it was the law. It was legal. I would say it was unethical because we were not. They said, "Oh, the money's coming. The money's coming. The money's coming." And guess what? A little bit of money came. You block grants to the state. So you guys know this. I'm going to give you policy. I'm going to give you MPH lesson right here, even though I don't have an MPH. But a lot of times, the way government gets away with things is they say, "Well, we're going to change this, and then we're going to give a little money to the states, and the states decide what to do with the money." Guess what happens? Even for excellent governors, if there's a huge deficit in the state budget and they're given a block grant to spend any way they want, do you think they give it to homeless, mentally ill people?
No.
No, of course not. They give it to their constituents. So, and I'm not saying, look, this is the left, the right. Only the middle usually sees the truth. I'm just going to tell you, the middle usually sees the truth if they're paying attention, which most, I think, Americans are not. So policy was legal. The homeless were disenfranchised. And you know, we did clean up our act eventually. And people like you in this room figured out other solutions. And we did, you know, but it took a really long time. And there's probably a lot of unnecessary deaths and suffering. So then we had the pork bill, with this little tiny caveat for managed care, where, and if you guys don't know this, I can't remember the name of the bill. Managed care companies got the government to say they could never be held liable for any decision they made that led to death or injury of a patient. And it was like, so this is the way Washington works. And you know what, the swamp is still there, so this is how they work. And I'm at both sides, everybody, whatever, I don't care. Mother Teresa, she was in Washington for, you know, a month. So, on a pork bill, the managed care companies got to be legally not liable for deficits of care in medicine and our field, which has always been the unfavored stepchild, by the way, of medicine, even academically. And I remember I was working at the Amber Hospital at that time, and I was a low-level, know-nothing fool. And everybody was saying, my administrator was like, "Oh, this is great. We made a couple contracts with Blue Cross Blue Shield and Aetna. We're going to get a preferred provider status." I said, "Yeah, for the first year. Then when they're in, they're going to come back and give you less percentage. So the first year, they're going to give you $100 an hour for your providers, right? And then they're going to give you whatever." And I'll tell you how I know this. My dad, can I just brag on my dad again? I'm going to cry. So he wound up becoming a vice president of General Electric from abject poverty. In fact, sitting in his hospital bed, he's telling me all this story that he never told me. That there were months that they ate chicken feet soup to survive. So I'm proud of my dad. So he got me reading on business. And, you know, this is worth it. It's a $200 subscription, but then you can go online and they have all these ethical forums. Because you need to know, if you're a clinician and you're obviously in a business role, you got to know. And guess what? Ethics are supposed to be part of every business decision, too. I'm here to talk about ethics in clinical world. In any event, I kept saying, well, this is what business does. If it's not illegal, most companies will be unethical, and they'll keep cutting back costs and cutting back costs and cutting back costs until there's political retribution, period. That's the way the world works. I'm really sorry my dad told me this, so I'm not actually that smart. So you could call yourself pink, purple, socialist, communist, leftist, LGBTQIAist, whatever you are. I don't care. It's the same, right? And don't be fooled by anyone who tells you any differently. Don't be a fool. You want to follow the money, right? And you have to understand that there will be nothing offered to us, at least in the next 2 years, that will benefit our field. There will be nothing offered to us. There will be nothing offered. And if we, like sheep, go in the way people did with managed care, oh, it's going to be great. Because does anybody know what the fallacy of attribution is? Fallacy of attribution is a very interesting psychological thing that we all do. We all accidentally project our own value system and beliefs onto the people we're with. That's why thieves always think that you're stealing from them. Right? You're like, who are the biggest cheaters? The people who think you're cheating them all the time, right? What's it, right? Somebody, or they could appear like schizophrenic, okay? But except for that, well, if somebody thinks you're always cheating them, don't leave your credit card laying around, right? I'll tell you that right now. So the fallacy of attribution hurts ethical people. Why? If we accidentally project the way we see the world onto people, and we all do it. Everybody, I do it, you do it. Everybody does it. We can see it unfolding now. It's what people do. So what happens if you accidentally project your values onto people and you don't even see it unconsciously?
They
can take you down really easily.
Well, you make them into something they're not.
You make them into something they're not, right, but what you're going to do is you're going to assume the best. Now, I try to do that, like one-on-one, when I'm talking to you, I'm like, oh, this person, I'm like, come visit, I'm like, but with systems, don't we all know this? How many people are social workers here? Systems are corrupt. If you have a couple and they're a system and you don't have a dog, you're going to have problems because it's imbalanced, right? You're going to have some balance there. Systems are corrupt and systems are not ethical. People are ethical. Okay? Systems inherently are not ethical. And you know who knew that really well? All of my nieces and nephews get it. I always do a theme gift every year on top of giving them money. The Bill of Rights. Everybody should have this on their wall next to their inspirational thing. Our founders knew how corrupt governments were, and they knew how corrupt royalty was, and they understood human nature. They didn't accidentally put into the First Amendment of the Constitution the five rights that they gave us, which are, when you hear something sad, I give speeches at high school all the time, and I used to hold out a $20 bill, and now I hold out a $50. And I go, somebody can come up here and answer one question about the Constitution, I'm going to give you this bill right now. And of course, they're all like, oh, and I go, no phones though, no phones. And they have to be standing right next to me, and I say, name the five rights given to you in the First Amendment of the Constitution. And I probably give about maybe 20 speeches a year. I used to do more. Guess how many times I've given that bill away?
Zero.
One time. I had the cutest, geekiest kid ever. This was like a Ferris Bueller's Day Off moment because he was like the geek fest, you could just tell. And he got up and he answered it, and the whole auditorium was going psycho. It was great. So if we don't know our rights, through fallacy of attribution, it's not too hard to have them all taken away. Do you understand me? And it's not hyperbolic. My dad was a history major before he went to business school. It's happening right now. So these are points. Oh, by the way, if you gave your email to the lovely folks that organized this, then I will send you the PowerPoint. So don't worry about any notes. If you want to opt out, then tell Matt, all right? So if you want to opt out of getting the PowerPoint, tell Matt. That's an easier way to do it then. Okay. So we really have to watch. The ACA is being dismantled as we speak, and already ethical physicians are stepping up and going, well, what are we going to do for people that are already in the middle of a chemotherapy regime, and then suddenly the $10,000 a month to save their life will be disrupted. We're in for some rocky times, and you know, medicine, the good news about how drastic it is managed care went after psychiatry and substance abuse first because nobody objects. I used to always say this when managed care was taking over and nobody listened to me then, but whatever, I still would do a little. Actually, I didn't give speeches then, I just talked at dinner parties where everybody would get up and leave. But okay, it's kind of nice if people want to hear me now. But everyone kept saying, oh, we're going to get rich on this managed care, it's great, quality assurance, it's going to be great. I'm like, great, we have the licenses, they have fax machines in Utah. Like, what? And I'll be like, wow, what are you people crazy? Don't you see? They're what? They have no incentive for good care because they're protected by the pork bill, right? The good news is, this is why, so I used to always say, if the managed care behaved for medicine as radically as they did for psychiatry, then here's the example. You would bring your child in for a broken leg to the ED, and they would say, oh, I'm really sorry. We just talked to the managed care company, and the bone hasn't broken through his skin, and he's not septic yet, so we're going to send you home, we're going to wrap it up, and then maybe come in and get some surgery later, right? But isn't that the same analogy that we dealt with for those? How many people have been in the field more than 25 years? Okay. So isn't that exactly what we dealt with? And what did they do? The managed care companies took a page out of Goebbels' book, like First Aid, it's a really great idea, right? It's a great idea, it's a good idea, it's good for everybody, it's going to make money for everybody, it's great. The whole country will go bankrupt if we don't do it, it's great, and then take away their rights first. Who did the Nazis kill first? The handicapped and the mentally ill. They got away with that. And they did it through an economic argument. That's what they did. And then they went for, who knows who they went for next? Homosexuals and the gypsies. And then they got away with it. Okay? So psychiatry wasn't prepared. We weren't lobbying. We didn't know we would be hit with managed care. And we were decimated. 80% of licensed treatment centers went out of business between 1984 and 1989. 80, different numbers, 68 to like 86. Okay, so we're facing that again, guys, and we gotta lobby. So all right. So the law may not protect us. We got to protect ourselves. You're going to get the... Okay, I'm going to say a little bit about evidence-based practices. This is a longer lecture than I give, but everything here I made is super easy for all you busy people like me. When you get the PowerPoint, you just click. Don't you love that? Now, how easy have we got? I don't even like to cut and paste anymore. I swear, I'm so bad. I just got to hit the thing. So I'm sending you everything you need to know to fight what's coming. You just got to click, 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 all right? If your practice right now doesn't have a tablet or computer-based clinical criteria, it's going to be the best $150 or $200 that you will ever spend. Okay? Because this is because, and I'll teach you the language too. I may not have time to get all into it today. Even when they come for us, it's so far, if we stick to ASAM criteria, or I'm going to give you a couple other criteria, they're going to be all clickable. Click, 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 click. And you can say that your facility has evidence-based practices. This works for practice group too. And you can, from your intake information, which you don't have to do on the tablet or the computer, but you could take a written. I still do written. I'm old school that way. Because I can't stand when my parents' doctors are talking to them like this. Right, do you know what I'm talking about? I don't like it. So I actually put like an extra 15 minutes into my busy schedule. I write little notes while I'm talking to them, then I just bing, 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 bing. And the ASAM is really, so people in substance abuse, the ASAM, and I'll get to the point of why I'm saying this. Oh, okay. So when you have, there's eight ASAM criteria. There is the AMA clinical criteria through the APA, American Psychiatric Association. All the links are in there. It basically, you answer questions, and then boom, it gives you, this is the acuity, this is the diagnosis, or they'll say, it's one of these diagnoses, and ask you more questions. So sometimes it's good. Once you get familiar with the software, you don't have to have it in front of you. In the beginning, you do, because you see the drop-downs, do you know what I mean, to ask more questions, and it's really accurate. And then boom, you can send it right to an insurance company, and they can't disagree, because these are certified criteria. Because if anything happens to your patient, if they disagree with the level of care, instantly, just send that to the lawyers, boom, open and shut lawsuit. All right, yes? Do you understand what I'm saying? Am I going too fast?
The name of the software again?
I can't tell you any particular software, but what I will have you do is you're gonna look up electronic medical records and EMR or EHR. I will tell you, ASAM is still taking pilots, so they'll give you their software for free for a year. However, without names attached, they want to look at your data because they're like improving. So I do some consulting for treatment agencies. I set up a treatment agency with that. I don't know if they'll do it for private practice or not. We use ASAM right now, but I'm expanding, to tell you the truth. I'm always improving. I have the hardest time. The mental health admissions, we've kind of got down. The substance abuse admissions are tougher, so I like the ASAM because it's just, and it rates acuity with potential loss of life and threat to life. So then they don't argue, you know why? Because it's liability. That's it. So I hate to say, so back to the fallacy of attribution. Think the way they think. We don't want to get sued. So if you just say, I really feel this person needs rehab, and this here's how social work is going to work. This person's been working an outpatient for 6-7 months. Then meanwhile they're playing solitaire on the other line, I swear to God. Not to be mean, but they're like, If you go, according to ASAM criteria, he meets 99.2 percentile for acuity death within a year. Oh, they stop playing solitaire. They go, okay, let me talk to my supervisor. I'm only being a tiny bit facetious because I have these phone calls with people all the time. By the way, everybody knows about the healthcare advocate in the state of Connecticut, right, for mental health, for all medical things. Okay, there's MAGA's data out there. Wait, what?
He's right here.
He's right here, woo! We love you guys. And we've never lost a case. Because we keep meticulous records, we have our families keep meticulous records, we even sit with the families that are disorganized and can't really get their, you know, what together, and we get on our fax machine, boom, 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 we've never lost a case. Families have gotten checks back for $50,000. Love you guys, can't say enough, hope you don't get cut in the funding. Okay, so how many psychiatrists here? I'm gonna skip over the psychiatry thing, except I'm gonna give a shout out to psychiatrists that are ethical. Ooh, did I say that? Okay, back to you. There's a market function for everything, right? Didn't I say that about the insurance companies? Unlike any other specialty. Well, no, there's a little bit. It's a little bit. Other specialties have this too. time is money in psychiatry. I know a doctor in my area who, he is so talented. He can see 8 patients an hour.
Oh, he's great.
I can't even believe, this man is a genius, and he'll tell you about it too if you talk to him for 5 minutes. I call him behind his back, I call him a psychic psychiatrist. I'm like, ooh, even a psychic that my friend dragged me to, gave me a half hour for less money, but it's rampant in the field, is it not? That's why I have a cherished little group. I have 2 doctors that work for Insight, and let me tell you something, if I could, I'd send them to a spa every weekend, you know, just to keep them, because they're just ethical. I've been at my father's hospital bed for a week and a half, and the doctors are texting me, what do you think of this? But only with the, and they're so sweet, it's good, it's keep my mind, oh, ding, 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 what is it? Uh-oh, I just thought of this. Did we know her cousin was on Lamictal, and did they ever get a diagnosis? Let me tell you, you want to know how to do a good bipolar diagnosis, differential diagnosis, instead of giving ADD medicine to somebody that's emerging bipolar? I swear to God, I'm going to shoot myself how many times that happens. Ask in detail about primary relatives. But you know you can't do that in 6 minutes. You can't. Because if I say to you, do you have any relatives with major psychiatric illness? Do you have any relatives that have bipolar illness? What are you going to say? No! Do you have any relatives who have disappeared and never come back? Do you have any relatives who were unemployable despite great intelligence? Do you have any people that were insane spenders in your family? Do you have any people that despite some psychiatric care, some abuse care, were chronically relapsing? It's not that hard to make bipolar diagnosis by history, right? So that takes time, right? And the great management professor, Peter Drake said, Peter Drucker, I'm sorry, said, things can be managed efficiently, but not people. People demand time. And so in our case, we would say to be cared for. And him, well, he was a great believer in management, actually was psychology, right? Management is psychology. So I think it's very hard for psychiatrists because they have to decide to make a lot less money to do the right thing. And that's where you're gonna see, I'm gonna tell you where we all get into trouble. Psychiatrists also, they have to have the highest ethical virtue within themselves because so much of what they do is based on some evidence-based suggestions, but really, the we all know there's 4 biological tests right now, and they're very weak. We know this. So everything has to come from their own intellectual curiosity and their own commitment to staying on the literature and whatever. And I'm not even kidding you. Like there's a few doctors that we work with in the community that are amazing. There's my 2 doctors who I worship in my practice. One of which would have been here today, but she decided to go visit 2 patients that are inpatient this morning. Imagine that. Imagine a psychiatrist who admits you outpatient and then goes to visit you in the hospital to make sure that you're being taken care of. Drop mic. Woo! Okay. But guess what? Her patients rarely get hospitalized. Right? Why? A good psychiatrist does what? Heavy loading in the front. Call access, call the family, talk to everyone. Heavy, heavy, heavy. Maybe I say, please, I want to treat you outpatient. I'm going to pick on you, sorry.
It's okay.
Because you're a friend, you're like, oh, my. So, listen, I really want to treat you outpatient, but it seems to me like the core, this, that, whatever, you might have bipolar with your substance use. If we put you in Silver Hill for 1.5 weeks and get your meds on quick, that might take 1 month outpatient. You could do something else stupid. This is how we talk about it. You could do something else stupid in 1 month and you go to prison, okay? But being a boom, go to. And then you do that, and no, seriously, I mean, we do it nicely. Because we don't do psychic counseling. We take some time. And then, boom, you put them in, you get them going, and then light on the end. Yeah. If you do light in the beginning, what happens? Well, it's a goddamn shit show, maybe for years, and my ethical problem is they might not make it. They're not going to make it. In fact, bipolar illness has a 10% acuity rate, you know, and so we don't mess with that. And how many of you work with chronic relapsers and substance use? Many of them are mood disorders that have not been. I'm just going to say it. You know, and in AA, I get criticized. I've been a member of AA for 32 years, and I tell my own story. I have major depressive disorder, recurring, severe, and I always say that as part of my story. And actually, the old timers are now on walkers come up to me, and they lecture me. And I go, AA has no opinion on outside matters, neither endorses or opposes any causes. That's part of my story. I'm going to keep saying it, but thanks for sharing. I say, keep coming. And usually, I have more time than some of the old people. So I go, keep coming. Those of us who can't get well usually have an underlying mood disorder, including major depressive disorders. Period. End of sentence. Drop mic, and the data supports me. Oh, and ASM criteria. Center, by the way, screens for the severe psychiatric. It's a Society of Addiction Medicine, but they do, the psychiatry markers are in there too. So if you do dual diagnosis, do ASIM, because you get both the QE for the substance abuse medicine. So Dr. Startwright is about to perform a double-blind randomized placebo-controlled clinical trial with a 2.5 twist. So that's how hard it is to be a good psychiatrist. It's hard. I'm saying it's hard. I make fun of the psychic psychiatrist, but it's hard. Evidence-based practices, everybody knows evidence-based practices, right? And they're emerging, and for those of you who don't know, I have it in the end. There's 4 excellent federal databases where some of them are free. Some of the manuals are free. So if you need to, and I'm always looking to improve our evidence-based practices. For example, therapeutic yoga, we always did as an add-on. Now that's one of the evidence-based practices, if it's done in a certain way. And then I have the documentation from National Institutes of NIMH. And it's awesome. And then you can just have that in your book of what you do. And you can do things in addition to evidence-based practices that are just nice. Like, we always have nice food for the patients. You know, we have a beautiful environment. You know, we have, one of my therapists is really into the aromatherapy. No evidence-based practice, except for lavender. You want to hear something weird?
Yep.
Lavender lowers the brainwaves. So that is one of the ones that's evidence, but the rest, it just smells good. So I'm like, yeah, it's just like Airwick, you know, whatever. So it's kumbaya, so we'll do it. But we can't say it's evidence-based, right? So we just do it as an extra. 12-step alone, I hate to say. No. If you're running a program that's 12-step alone, you are not evidence-based. Which doesn't mean that AA doesn't work, okay? But just, you have to have evidence-based treatment in there. And I would argue that being a member of 12 steps for 32 years, AA was DBT before DBT was DBT. But we didn't subject ourselves to randomized testing. And they chose not to, which was because it's anonymous, and you can't. Although there's a couple really interesting correlative studies that show high efficacy for people that continue to go to meetings. That's a self-selected group. That's not a controlled study, do you understand? So that's one of the reasons why AA can never be scientifically validated, because you would have to randomly assign 100,000 people or 20,000 people and say to some people, you can't ever go to an AA meeting, you go once a month, and you go 6 times a week. Could you imagine doing that study? It can't be done. All right, marketing. Can I talk to you guys about marketing? Can we talk marketing? Now the gloves are coming off. You think I was bad before. Okay, wait. Oh, I forgot to also mention one of my favorite ethicists who passed away a number of years ago, George Carlin. I've been listening to him lately. I swear, from the grave, if you listen to the things he was saying in the early 80s, just fill in the blanks. We could have one of those kids, the audio engineers, just fill in the names with different names. Same shit. And what I love about George Carlin is he doesn't trust anybody. Like, he's angry at everybody all the time, whatever. And interestingly enough, he was raised in the same neighborhood as my dad in the Bronx and went to one of the same schools my dad did. And he didn't trust religion eventually, but you can hear the Jesuits in him, or I think he went to the Benedictine Catholic school. Like, if something's not logical, it's not logical, and then he would be fine, right? Who loves George Carlin? Come on. The man was the man. And for you kids that don't know him, school yourself up. He's awesome. Okay, so NATAP, which, to tell you the truth, the jury is out for me if NATAP is going to be an effective organization. I'm going to say that. What? NATAP is the National Association of Addiction Treatment Providers. And they are a group that is trying to have standardization and ethics. And they're trying really hard to kind of corral our field to stick to evidence-based practices and not become thoroughly medicalized, but to submit ourselves to rigorous testing so we can't be screwed by the insurance companies when they do come to take away our ability to function. But the problem is, right now, for example, if I just wrote them a check for $500, I could put on my website NATAP, certified member of NATAP. I mean, I filled out the application and I was just about to write the check. And then I've gone to their conferences and stuff. And then I call them, I'm like, well, what else do you do? Site visit? No, we just, you know. So That's all I have to say about that. But they are trying, and they did come out with a marketing piece of ethics, because one of the things that's really gotten my goat, I have a few former friends, it's kind of breaks my heart, who made friends with venture capital and suddenly started saying all kinds of cuckoo things to me that made no sense. And did all kinds of marketing things that were not true. And how many people know the 12th step of AA? Part of it is having had a spiritual awakening in the 12th step. And practice these principles in all our affairs, right? So that's what makes ethics hard. So I've had people say to me, Liz, it's only business. Why you gotta poke everybody? So it's one thing to be mansplained. I've been woman-splained. I've been executive director-splained. I've been splained up and down and sideways. And I say, well, you know, let's do the diaper test. You know what the diaper test is in ethics? Does it smell? Does it smell? Does it smell? Like, can you peek in there and ooh? If you keep that diaper on, you can say it's clean. Did you take it off? Right? And this is a tough standard. You certainly should be able to have practices that you consider proprietary, right? And this is where I actually come from academia, and I teach at Harvard CME a couple times a year. Academics don't believe generally in trademarking ideas, right? If you have something that really works, you're supposed to be ethically bound to share it, right? So that's the insane platinum standard, but why not? Why not share it if it alleviates suffering? Because I would believe if you're really the best, okay, here's the thing. So if you're ethical, you have to work really hard because you always have to be on the cutting edge. You gotta read, you gotta go to things like this, you gotta network, ding, 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 ding. And you really have to be bigger, better, faster, kinder, whatever. And you're still gonna make less money than the unethical people in the short term.
Yeah.
Okay, and I'm just gonna say to you, I make half the money I could make. I had one lunch meeting. We have four children, my husband and I were very, very blessed. And I had a goal to get them all through college without debt. Not graduate school, although my son got his PhD for free. Except to say, sorry. And it was mean to him the entire time. Mean, 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 rotten, rotten, rotten. When he was young. And now he's helping me take care of my elderly parents. He's 28. He's such a good boy. But he got arrested for weed when he was in high school. Oh, yeah. Senior year of high school. Stupid dumbass. And I had told him, you get arrested for something stupid, you're going to stay in jail overnight. And then Daddy and I will see. We'll see what we're going to do. Actually, he didn't sit in jail in Reading. He got arrested in my town. In my town. I live in a town of 8,000 people. I know all the cops. They call me up. Chris is here, of course. My husband is away. And by the way, if you live in a coupledom, your spouse will be away whenever the shit hits the fan. We just say that. We just say it.
Absolutely.
So true. It's absolutely. It's just one of those Murphy's Laws, okay? And although I did get to control the whole situation, so that was kind of good too. But no, my husband's a good guy. We usually while we're laughing behind the scenes at what idiots our kids are, the way we were. Where did I go? Oh, I lost it. What was I saying? Oh, about ethics. So you're going to make less money. So I was sitting at a luncheon by somebody who had been buttering me up, and like suddenly I'm the best thing. I'm better than everything. They love me. So you always know. If a patient does it to you, what do you know? Oh, you're the best. I've been to so many therapies.
Yeah, right.
I'm living. Okay, you know. Well, with that, you know it's coming. I hate you. You're the worst. Okay, so this is a professional marketing person. I figured, that's not going to happen, but we love you, we do, hearing your name everywhere. So, in the middle of this conversation, all of a sudden I realized that I'm being offered a finder's fee, which is unethical. And it wouldn't pay my kids' tuition. Okay, so this is not my ethical. I'm like, and maybe you make a speech once a month for us if you're not busy, right? Well, that doesn't make sense. So, if you're hiring me to make speeches, I gotta make the speech, right? Not so fast, you don't have to, right? So these things are hard, and that is considered unethical, and yet it's done all the time. And something to be aware, there is not, you can't justify it, you just can't. You can't. In fact, put a bunch of places in Florida getting shut down now.
Does this speech count as the one that you're gonna do for us?
Which one? No, I actually don't work for them at all, nothing. Especially since you stole Sarah. And the other thing is, you're not supposed to have clients do testimonials. This makes me psychotic. And when I hear treatment centers sending their own patients out to do speeches on behalf, I go lunatic,
psychotic. You know why? Once I'm your therapist, we are never equal in power ever again. You could be 62 and I'm 89 and we wind up in the same nursing home. And I have power over you. Okay? And here's where non-clinical people, I can understand how someone who went to business school doesn't really get that. Anyone who's gone to therapy, who fell in love with their therapist a couple times, I mean, actually, two women, that kind of love, like, you know, whatever, because I'm cis, whatever. You know, like, if my therapist said, would you get up in Madison Square Garden and tell your story, I'd be like, oh my God, yes, for you, Barbara, would do anything to save my life. Okay, you can't do it, you shouldn't do it. If you do it, you can get away with it, but it's still unethical. That's one of the big ones that NATAP is on. Okay, evidence-based. Oh, here's where, okay, so I told you the ASAM criteria. ASAM, if everybody needs a suicide risk assessment, best practices thing. And most of the time you can have, most people have that in their good clinical assessment sheet, but this one is standardized and there's six, actually SAMHSA has an integrated tool you can add to whatever you're doing. It's very easy to use. This all, if you have your email, we're gonna send it all to you, so you don't even have to write it down. This is a great part of understanding the networkofpractice.org, where there's all kinds of resources to do evidence-based practices, to do documentation the right way. Like, for example, with the electronic health record stuff I was saying before, they've through networkofpractice.org, they have vetted every single software program, because of course this is a new business thing, so you know there's a lot of things popping up. So this is, listen, if you don't follow up with almost anything else that I said, do the network of practice. First of all, read this, the First Amendment of the Constitution, memorize it if you don't have it, and do network practice.org. Okay, I'm just gonna say, so stage change theory, actually I'm gonna skip it. You guys all know the stage change theory, right? Okay. I'm gonna skip that then, if you don't mind. Oh, I just loved it. The University of Pennsylvania has a scattergood program for applied ethics in behavioral care, healthcare. And it's great. And that's a real guy's name. Scattergood. That was actually his real Puritan name. This kind of stuff just makes me go. Like, you know, you have a bad day and things are going wrong and you're listening to the news and stuff like that. So he was the first Quaker physician and a minister. Well, and then back then you could be a physician by just following him. Because they couldn't do anything for it. It's helped you die comfortably. But, and the Quakers were the first to open mental hospitals in the United States. And they called it environmental care. And it just meant that they had like little group homes. And then, yes, you would be forced to go to a friends meeting. But have you ever been to a friends meeting?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You just sit in a circle and anybody wants, it's like an AA meeting without AA. You sit, and then whoever wants to say something, they say it. And it's kind of like Unitarian Universalism. You say whatever you want. Talking about Muhammad and Allah, whatever, they don't care. So he instituted basically the beginning of ethics in mental health care, and there's this institute, and if you go on their website, scattergoodethics.org, they have all kinds of amazing resources. So here's the thing, I'm close to the end of this, and I'm gonna tell you about my four ethical mistakes that I've made, and gonna cover up the details of the people involved, except for me. But so why do good people do bad things in our field? This is my opinion, but I really do want some Q&A and like some interaction and hopefully no shouting and screaming. But fear is what makes us mostly do stupid ass things. I mean, you know, that's just human. And we all have fear and we all have a survival instinct, we do. And we're not hunters and gatherers anymore. We're not food scarce, right? We're all chubby, basically. We're not food scarce. So where does our natural programmed evolutionary fear tend to focus? On the almighty dollar, right? And I don't know about you, how many people, you know who Anne Ryan was, right? Fountainhead, and Atlas Shrugged, and then next to her coffin, she had prearranged this, were floral displays of money signs all around. I don't know about you, I don't think I'm gonna pass on that. With a couple of my friends who I've been deeply disappointed with, I don't think they understand they're under the power of gold, right? Which is nothing to be said. Listen, I have four kids to educate. I have nothing against making a decent living.
It's how you make it.
Well, it's how you make it. And you pay me now, or you pay me a lot more later, right? So that works for losses. So if you don't take care of public health issues, You save money on your budget or your quarter or whatever, and then you have horrible consequences later. We know this in public policy, we know this in health, we know this happened in AIDS. This will happen if ACA is dismantled. We're gonna have nightmare ethical problems that might, although scientists and physicians are marching on Washington. They're done. Because they can finally give cancer care or whatever, and they're like, this, we're not going back. You know, they're like, in fact, I was in Hartford for 2 hours with Allie the other day. My friend made me leave the hospital, drove me there, and was like drinking Starbucks and crying. My dad really was not doing well. The funny sign I saw, now you've gone and pissed off grandma. I love that.
Lady in a scooter.
And then there was another one. You know things are bad when librarians come out to protest. My dad, the day he fell and broke his hip, he was at the Scranton Library in Madison doing his 4 hours of book shelving, and he has like three girlfriends at the library. He's 86, he's Mr. 86 with osteoporosis like this at the library every day. So cute. And so I had to take a picture. I said, Papa, look, the Republic will survive. Okay, can I say one other funny thing? Now, my dad was a Republican most of his life. He came back on November 9th, and I'm up there a couple times a week to take care of him, and he goes, Liz, I told your mother the first time I ever never crazy about her until Trump was nominated. So, but in the hospital with an elder, do you know they ask them all the time? They orientate sometimes the day, the time, the year. So I knew my dad was going to pull through. The first few days, they're like, Mr. Driscoll, do you know what day it is? And he's looking at me. Because I was the only one like answering. I'm like, oh shit. My dad was a vice president of General Electric. You know, like, sharp guy. He had photographic memory to look at 2 years ago. So about 4 days ago, I knew my dad was going to make it when they said, what day is it? He goes, January 25th, it's on the board. Because they have a board at the end of the day. They got a board at the end of the day. It's funny shit right there. And then they go, they say, what month is it? He goes, January 25th. And start getting sarcastic again. And they go, it was two residents, gerontology residents, so cute, so adorable. Maybe they were 26, 27, I don't know. And they go, who's the president of the United States? He goes, and they were laughing. They go, we're hearing a lot of that. And I go, I bet you are. I bet you are. That's so funny. Okay. So, fear makes us do a deal with the devil. And my faith tradition was Christianity, although this isn't the Bhagavad Gita, this isn't all the big biggies. It's not money that's evil. What is it? The love of
worship.
It's worshiping money. I have nothing. Our credo, our inside credo of inside counseling is we want to do the best possible ethical work, take care of all of our clients as we would care for family, and make a decent living. See, I like the DBT, the and, right? You don't have to suffer. Like the first few agencies I worked for, you know, we were like, oh, aren't we so lucky just to make $8 an hour? Like, meanwhile, the CEO was making like a, you know, whatever. Like, no, that doesn't make sense. So, early role models, if you have ethical lapses in early role models, it really can have an impact. It can, and I was very lucky to have hardcore, really boom, Nazi kind of social work trainers that, you know. And good supervision is so, so important. And in fact, all the studies of ethical breaches, usually there's a breakdown in supervision from good people. I mean, some people are just unethical, and that's it. Can't fix stupid, can't fix dishonest, if somebody wants to be dishonest, right? But supervision sometimes, you know, that's hurt me. And I have this thing, if you want a lot of money, you know, sell pork bellies or become a lobbyist. You know, I don't know what to tell you. Like, you shouldn't be in health care for just for the money, because by definition, you will be unethical. I would say if there's nothing wrong with making a good living, but if that's the decision tree, you know how you make decision trees? What makes the most money, then what? Right away, you know it's not going to work for you and for us. And I would say most ethical breaches are by omission. You don't want to pick up that phone and call in the child protective. You know, because this person has been doing better, and they didn't need to drive drunk, and they drove to your office drunk, and your kids are waiting. Okay, I've made those calls, and that's fucking hard, excuse me. But I'm apologizing to my own podcast, but... you know what? The law doesn't give us a choice, and ethics don't give you a choice, right? And you got to do it. And I've had families come back and thank me. I've been the only time I've ever been. well, let me back up, because I've been doing this 30 years. I've had many threats of being sued. Most of them were for child protective calls and in a divorce. In fact, I wish it was ethical to when a family calls in, if I could say, are you currently going through a divorce? You're not allowed to ask. Because it's unethical, but right? How many people were with adolescents? Okay. Don't you love that? Finally, they never got therapy for the kid when they're hypocritic, peeing, sobbing in school, school avoidance, as soon as they file for divorce. Suddenly, but it's hard to deal with these people. They threaten you. I have good liability insurance, and if you have good Samaritan laws, so you're allowed to. You only have to report suspected child abuse or neglect or elder abuse or neglect. Suspected. So you are clear, free and clear, if someone sues you. And I used to keep a folder of all the letters. Now I just put them on. I'm like, yeah, that just cost you $500, right? Because you were shooting up in front of your kid told me. So, bada bing, bada boom, boom. Good for you that the DCF was at your house.
Well, my population, they threatened to kill me. So, threatening to sue was, a little milder.
I hope is that hopefully criteria for transfer?
Not necessarily.
Oh,
not
really?
In the Connecticut Mental Health Center.
I thought you meant it. That's a special kind of thing.
Yeah.
Oh, no, thank you for saying that. I've been there too. I mean, I worked at Denver Hospital for 18 years, and I had people tell me they had weapons in a bag, and luckily I'm a good liar and manipulator, and I'd be like, oh, yeah, that's cool, I'm only the NRA, I love the guns too. Like, oh, hold on a second, I go get a pee, boom, run out, call the cops, call it.
You know, I've been assaulted by a patient at Connecticut Mental Health Center, and they were, public safety was going to let him walk out the door because they didn't want to bring attention to it. Until, while I was being taken out with stretcher in the ambulance, one of the clinicians in acute services, thank God, said, what the hell are you doing? This guy has to be arrested.
And I would argue, so there's a social worker, I would argue that's the highest ethical decision because he'll get better care being forced into care by the judicial system.
Right.
So I would argue when it comes to that, judicial is not our enemy. Judicial with an adolescent, I love it. I'm on my knees praying that some of my patients get arrested. But seriously, before they're 18th birthday, I'm like, please, Jesus, something stupid. Let them get arrested for smoking weed in his car. You know, so then maybe we have some teeth. But, I one of my mentors, I'm going to tell you my breaches real quick, and then we're going to end for whatever, for kumbaya. Someone who was a cherished mentor, and I'm telling you, cherished, like not just a little bit. And one of my cherished mentors is still living, he's 83, Dr. Edward Kianstein. If you ever been to the Harvard Addictions Conference, you'll know him. He's the big teddy bear who speaks, and very humbly. He's the one who coined and started the field thinking that maybe addicts were self-medicated, okay? But in the early 80s and late 70s, that was a radical idea that was shunned by psychiatry. Because psychiatry believed addiction always came from severe character. I was around then. I was in graduate school then, fuming because I had to pay $8,000 a year out of my own pocket to listen to that shit. Oh, by the way, cold mothers caused autism.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Remember
that
shit? Excuse me, how many people? I know how old you can raise your hand. Remember that?
Yeah.
And I remember raising my hand and going, professor, I grew up in Brooklyn, New York with Hasids on one side. And my family was Catholic. We only had four, but, nine kids from the Hasids, nine kids from the Catholics. So as far as, six and one half, there's another. So people would have one autistic child in the middle of eight children. So what did Mama do? She loved all of them? And that's not what evidence suggests. But there's no evidence, it's your opinion. So that's another thing. Sometimes best practices become obsolete, right? But anyway, my mentor, who I adored, never had a substance abuse problem. He had an anxiety disorder, but it was good. He was OCD. So we'd write grants together. We'd be there till 2 o'clock. He had a very bad back injury. This is after I left Denver Hospital to start my own practice, and we kept in touch, and ding dong dong, whatever. And I met him for lunch one time, and he was just funky. He was funky, and he had the glassy eyes. Don't you hate when you know what's going on, and you can't do a damn thing about it? And so I'll call him David. I said, David, you okay with your back, whatever? Oh, yeah, I have to be on painkillers all the time, and I'm okay. Oh, really, all the time? Like, who are you seeing? He mentioned a doctor who's one of these psychic pain doctors. David, he's not a good doctor. Don't you go and start talking about him. He tells me that you say shit about him behind his back, because I don't. If my patients are seeing this particular pain doctor, they have to switch. And
and my heart just sank in that lunch. Why? Well, I knew also about how to defend, because I was saying it from my heart, like, oh,
yep.
David, that's not the best behavior. Right? I mean, I didn't say it like, he's a mess. I was like,
matter.
Even though I was thinking that. Yeah. How many people have that good strategy of like the split screen in your head? Can you do that? I'll tell you something, when I'm vulnerable, you know, the chain analysis for DBT, when I'm vulnerable, the split screen shuts down. I start yelling at nurses and stuff like that. But sometimes it gets a painkiller to my dad, so that's okay. But I had the split screen up that day, and I was trying to argue. I go, look, you know how many of my young patients? I had been in my own practice for a couple of years, and he had since retired from that hospital, but not, he was still in like private practice a little bit. And he wouldn't listen, right? So then I, you know, me, oh, fallacy of attribution, let's still say, oh, he's a great guy, he's always been a great guy, and I knew his wife really well, whatever. So I ran a conference, and I had him come as one of the speakers. He comes in to speak, he was disoriented, and he was sucking on a fentanyl lollipop. Literally broke my heart. Plus, I had to keep my shit together to like run the conference. So what was my ethical debate? What would the highest code of ethics to a practicing physician? What do you have to do? You know that
reports.
You gotta report them. You have to report them. And he was still practicing. He was retired? No. You can't get around it. So what did Liz do? I decided to ignore everything that I just told you up to this point and call all my. Do you guys have a holy shit list of people you trust no matter what?
Yeah.
Okay. Everybody has to have a holy shit list.
Yep.
Okay. And you gotta have at least like four or five people. And I already have enough people that I'm on their holy shit list, even though if you don't have one yet, I can guide you in your area probably, and we all call each other, and everybody on the holy shit list said, you have no choice. It was a killer. It was a killer. And I went onto the DPH website, and I saw someone else had already taken it. And I gotta tell you something, I was so relieved, I'm not gonna lie. I was ready to make the call. Instead, I was obsessively looking at our public health, like, how do you do it? And I saw he had already been awarded. And that his license was being reviewed. And I tell you something, I want to say I would have made the call anyway.
You don't know that.
I actually don't know, I honestly. And the reason I don't know is because I didn't have to make the decision. You know? So that's where ethics are at. I'm not saying I sound like a self-righteous bitch for the first hour of my speech, but. The omission is where you're going to get, that's where the sand is going to wind up in your bathing suit. Do you know what I'm saying? That's where it's now going to be good. The other thing is, if you have an employee that you love and they become impaired, what do? They're otherwise highly productive. You got to report them. You got to do, well, if you have to follow labor law. So you have to document. You have to go by behaviors of risk and concern, telling what you see, what you observe, what you understand. I believe in getting an EPA help, but if they won't, you got to turn them in. I've a couple times practiced beyond my scope by saying things like, you shouldn't be on that medicine. Take it back. I'm a master's level clinician. I'm a social worker. I can't say that. And, I got hooked. Something that's too good to be true always is, right, ladies and gentlemen? I took a consulting job that I thought was great, kumbaya, tuition paid, yada, yada, yada. About 4 months into it, I opened up the secret locked door of this particular organization, and I said, holy crap. And luckily, I at the same time started to be the caregiver for my parents, so it was an easy out to get out of my contract. And I didn't report them right to the state because what they were doing were marketing ethical violations and the state doesn't take those referrals. But I did what I had to do because there were ethical people that were on the board of directors and they called me saying, why on earth are you resigning? We don't want you to resign. And I said, okay, I'm evoking whistleblower protection even though I'm not taking you to court. And I told them the story and the two most unethical people were consequently fired within a month. So I still felt good. And then they tried to get me to go back. So that's it. So questions, answers. I know you guys have to go. Hopefully, oh wait, I have a good little Peppy slide. Peppy. Oh, this is just one more funny cartoon. Remember when he was really popular? What's his name? Gary Larson, right? Yes, yes, I know that, Sydney. Everyone knows that. But look, 4 wrongs squared minus 2 wrongs to the 4th power divided by this formula do make a right. But ethics are easy. They're simple, they're not easy. I'm sorry, I said that all wrong. Ethics are simple, but they're not easy. That's why I use those case studies of like my mentor that wasn't easy. Every religious, you know,
And Socrates, happiness is the byproduct of right living. I try to bang that into my 18-year-old clients. Like, yeah, it's really hard to do the right thing. Yeah, you make $4,000 a week as a drug dealer, but, you know, let's get you working at Mickey D's. It's going to be worth it. You know, it's a tough sell. But this is true. So Socrates, who didn't believe in any gods or any spirit or anything, I think he was correct. AA, do the next right thing. The next right thing will happen. Thank you very much for your time. And we're going to email you the presentation so you can click all the other things. And don't give up. We just all have to be. You got to do what the old people do. Start calling your legislatures.
Yep.
State first. Don't forget the state. Don't forget the state. People go right to their Congress and their Senate. The state, but okay, California. Jerry Brown is saying we're gonna use the Republicans' tactics against them. We didn't say it this way. States' rights. I'm evoking state rights. California will keep Affordable Care Act. So I think there's gonna be a movement if the citizens say we want to keep this in Connecticut. We don't want to stop. We want our citizens. I don't know about you. I would rather have, because we all paid for the uninsured before. Did you know that? This is where the Democrats are stupid. Did you ever see a commercial where the Democrats said, hey, before when people didn't have insurance and then they had to lose their house, I'm on the board of a homeless shelter that was mostly families for 15 years, where one spouse there, and maybe a nurse and a carpenter, not a lot of savings, kids, one gets cancer, they're kicked off their insurance, and then what do you say? Oh, honey, you don't have any more money, so you're just gonna have to die. No, they do what you would have done. They keep paying till they can't pay anymore, lose the house, whatever, then wind up homeless after their spouse dies.